Hi, this is Paul. I had noticed that Michaela hadn't been putting out videos for a while, and then suddenly today, boom, new video on her channel with Jordan. Of course, I'll go serve that up to me right away. And I'm only going to talk about the first part of the video until they get to the Peterson Academy stuff, which is I have other thoughts about. But I wanted to deal with this because I thought this was just prime. This was the sort of thing that we saw a lot of in the Genesis series, in the classroom lectures. This is sort of Jordan relaxed with his daughter. This was really good.
Yeah, finally. But thank you for being the intro back into the online world.
I'm looking forward to it, kiddo.
So, I think it was last week I saw a video going around of you describing the worst breakfast you've ever had. Your
Oh,
breakfast from
yeah, that's a
hell.
funny one.
And that has millions of views. And it reminded me of going to the restaurant near our house when we were kids. And I remember one time you
This is a great story.
didn't like
It, it's it's stories like this that make the family conversations so cool.
breakfast, and you got up and taught the cook how to cook. So I thought we could open with why
Why
on
did that
earth you did that.
amuse you?
Because a normal person would quietly complain about.
The therapist in him. He doesn't have any clients, so he's got to work on his daughter. Why did that abuse you?
Their breakfast with other people at the table and then eat most of it out of guilt and then not come back. And you did not do that.
Okay, so
And she's exactly right.
yeah, so this is a little restaurant, a little diner by our house.
Yeah, cost.
And I knew the owner, and I liked her. And I liked going there for breakfast. I used to bring my graduate students there, and we'd have breakfast there.
Yeah.
And we had meetings that were very productive, and that breakfast was excellent. And so, what does that mean? It means that the potatoes were fresh and that they were cooked crispy and golden and not brown and soggy and horrible.
But poor Jordan, he gets to talk about this and he can't eat it anymore.
And old and sometimes rotten, because you can do all those if you really want to. And the orange juice was like made out of oranges instead of whatever the hell they fed astronauts in 1957. And the coffee was fresh, and the bacon was actually made out of pork instead of whatever the hell you make bacon out of when you don't have a pig. And it was good, and so I liked coming there. And I liked the woman. She's a hardworking immigrant woman, and she ran a good restaurant. It was very welcoming. And they had a great cook. And then they brought in this new guy, and it was like second rate. And I thought, it doesn't have to be second rate. Maybe he's lazy, in which case he should go, or maybe he just doesn't know what the hell he's doing. And I thought, well, I don't want to be pissed off about this and never come back and grumble about it. I'd rather come here and have a good breakfast. So I thought, well, and I worked as a short order cook for years and knew the difference between how to cook, hash browns properly and improperly. And I went in and told.
So somewhere there's a dude out there who's got this story too, and he should find his way to the internet and let us know exactly what it was like from his side.
Like what was wrong in detail, why this didn't work, and what he could do instead. And he responded positively because I wasn't going in there giving him hell. I was doing exactly what I just told you. It's like I wanted to go to this restaurant. It was all set up. I liked the woman, and he might as well do it right. And so that's what I did.
Did
You thought that
breakfast.
was amusing,
I thought
didn't
it was
you?
really funny. Did breakfast and
Breakfast
anxiety provoking.
improved very dramatically.
It's funny.
And he didn't have to change his spot.
Yeah, so there was no downside to that too, because you go out to a place and you don't get treated well, it just pisses you off, and then you don't say anything because you're so polite. And it's understandable to some degree, but it's not helpful because then you go away and you're irritated because you didn't get what you bargained for, and then you don't go back. And if that happens to a small business, it doesn't have to happen that often, and people just don't go. And then if maybe the owner doesn't even know. And so then their business vanishes out from underneath them, and that's not helpful. If he would have got all uppity and squawky about it, that wouldn't have gone well. But I wasn't being mean, and I wasn't trying to like parade my knowledge of hash browns around. I just wanted to keep going to that diner. So, yeah.
Now, it's going to take a turn here. And again, this was a lot of what made the classroom lectures, the early stuff, so helpful. He still does it on stage. You'll catch it in a lot of his live shows. But again, we're not focusing on a culture war issue. This is a father-daughter talking. This is just so sweet.
All right.
Mm-hmm. It's a little bit funny.
I guess it's a little bit funny, I suppose. Yeah.
So I thought we should...
No, the other thing about that, too, is like if you're at a restaurant and you have good service, it's really helpful to tell the people what they did right in detail. And this is a good thing to know in your life in general. Like,
there's a little book. I just came across it. I should pull it out. Now I'm going to tell stories. Used to have a rice farmer in the church, and he was born and raised Christian Reformed. Just absolute lovely man. He passed away a number of years ago. Very successful guy. And he, back when I got to Living Stones, the seeker movement was sort of, it was past its heyday, but it's still in steam. And even before I took the call, our whole classes had decided to go out to Willow Creek. And that was, of course, apply business ideas to the church, that whole thing in the 90s. And of course, this rice farmer, people think farmers as being of the land, but farmers are really businessmen. If you're going to be a successful farmer, you're going to be a just absolutely successful businessman because there's a lot of things to manage. And I remember he turned me onto this book, and it was called The 1 Minute Manager. And it's basically exactly what Peterson is talking about here. It's the whole idea of Ken Blanchard. He was a business guru back when, you know, they were churning out these business books like crazy, and Home Missions was sending the pastors these business books. And I still have a bunch of them on my shelf. I'm going to recycle. I didn't find hardly any of it worth anything in terms of pastoring. But this little book was really quite good. And basically, it's exactly like Peterson says in terms of catch someone in the act of doing the right thing and reward them. And so now he's going to talk about positive reinforcement.
If you go somewhere and people go a bit out of their way to make it go well for you, and you tell them what they did in detail and you thank them for it, they're so happy, you can't believe it. And then they're way more likely to do that again in the future, because there isn't anything, B.F. Skinner figured this out. Skinner could teach an animal to do anything. Skinner taught rats to dance and to climb ladders and to peck on photographs to guide missiles. And that was pigeons. And
oh, wow.
Skinner That's could cool. teach animals to do anything.
Terrifying,
and he said you can teach an animal using threat. So that produces anxiety. You can use punishment.
This is very germane to me since I'm in, you know, still in puppy prison. And the heart of puppy prison is we have to deal with this program. And this program is all about positive reinforcement. And it's exactly what Peterson is saying here.
Like electric shock, minor electric shock, the behaviorists would do that, which isn't as harsh as it sounds because it's, you know, minor irritant, essentially. Or you can use reward. Now, reward is hard to use, eh? Because if you're going to teach an animal by using reward, you have to watch them, and then you have to wait till you see them do something that you want them to repeat, and then you have to reward them right.
That's exactly. It's all attention.
There and that. So you have to be very, very attentive to use reward. And so often people don't use reward in their lives because they don't pay enough attention, or maybe they're afraid to actually communicate what they want. But it's unbelievably powerful. And so if you watch your kids or your wife, your friends, and I don't mean to do this manipulatively because that's stupid, but if they do something that you would like to see repeated and you notice it, you think, oh, that went real well. You went out of your way, you stepped up, you improved your performance. Even if it's just a minor improvement sort of on the edge, if you identify that.
That's exactly what this book says. Tiny little book, just a little book, 1 point. You don't even have to buy the book, that's the point.
Describe it in detail and call it out. It's so motivating for people, you just can't believe it. You can just call out the best in people constantly by doing that. You can do it to yourself too, you know, if you notice that you've made a little progress forward, instead of bitching at yourself about how you're slightly less useless than you once were, you know, and sort of down.
You know, these little tearing yourself down speeches that Peter said, you know, these come from him. You know, this is inside of him.
And with faint praise, you can notice that you took a step, however small, in the right direction, and, you know, treat yourself with a bit of appreciation in consequence. It's one of the things you teach people if you're a behavioral psychologist, is to teach them how to reward themselves for taking incremental steps towards their desired goal. Yeah.
Do you think that works for people across the board, or do you think some people react more to punishment?
No, it's some people don't react at all to punishment. Like Julian, your brother, was a good example of that. He was just too ornery and tough to react really he didn't react well to punishment. We used to use timeout on him because you can use timeout on kids.
I had one kid too that I remember telling his basketball coach, I said, there's no amount of punishment you can legally administer this kid that will get you what you want, get him to do what you want him to do. He's going to need to want to do it himself. That's just the way that kid is wired.
He was way more responsive to reward. You were more sensitive to punishment in that with you when you were a little kid, really all I had to do was, you know, point my finger at you and look and you'd stop, Julian. That was like, that was just an invitation to tango for him. So, but reward fundamentally, reward, you want to use threat and punishment sparingly, very, very sparingly. You know, you bring out the big guns only when necessary, and but reward is, it's so useful. And
this is, he's right. And I know on the internet people love threat and punishment, but what he's saying is true in real life. And if you've got real life relationships, it's true.
But it requires careful focal attention, you know?
I think Scarlett's like that. She hardly needs it. Like, if you just look at her sideways when she's done something wrong, she cries.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, right.
But not in like a depressed way, you know, what did I do wrong? Oh my gosh.
Yeah, well, that cry. So the way your nervous system works, basically, this is one of the ways you learn, is that imagine that there's a sequence of activation of neurons in a pattern, like a musical pattern, right? And so whenever you're manifesting a given behavior, there's a symphony of neurons that are firing that accompany that or that precede it.
Now, this is where the video really, I think, starts to take off in terms of a lot of things that I'm interested in. What's interesting about this is that, again, these neurons are all mapped to things out there in the world that are relational, at least as much as they are physical.
Now, if the symphony of neural pattern produces a desired outcome, then that produces a release of dopamine. And the dopamine does two things. Is one, it makes you feel good. Mm-hmm. And the second is that it makes the neurons that were most recently active grow, the connections between them, and strengthen. So
now, again, like I said, they're relational. And a lot of the things you're talking about in terms of praise, I mean, praise also has a fair amount to do with status. Praise from anybody is positive, but praise from high status people is especially positive. And so, in other words, these dopamine reactions are in fact tied to this entire relational matrix that we're living in. It's mapped onto the first draft that we have. I just want to mention that because in this materialist age, we tend to listen to a story like this and it tends to sort of reinforce materialism, but it's actually extremely relational.
Sort of in proportion to how, like the farther back in time they were activated, the less dopamine they're flooded by. So any behavioral pattern, neural pattern that's resulted in a positive consequence gets bathed in dopamine and then strengthens. It's like the weight strengthening in a large language model. It's the same thing. And so if you reward people for performing properly, then what they did is reinforced by the dopamine as well as rewarded. So the reinforcement is the growth and the reward is the subjective feeling. And if you punish them for it, we don't exactly know how punishment works neurologically, or at least I don't know, but
which is super interesting.
It weakens the connections and kills the patterns. And I think that the feeling of negative emotion that is associated with failure, let's say, is actually a signal of the death of part of you, right? The impending death.
Now, pretty much everybody knows in terms of the sports world, it hurts way more to lose than it feels good to win. And so it is this death. And again, this death is on the backdrop of a mapping, and it's very much a relational, you know, what is, in terms of the physical world, if you were an alien looking down and you knew nothing of planet Earth, you'd watch a whole bunch of people run around on a field with a ball, and you'd watch all these people in the stands, and they're all making noise. And if you had no idea of what the game was, you would know, in a sense, nothing of the game. But it could be the Super Bowl, and people are either going to be, their fortunes will change based on the outcome of that. Whereas an alien watching all of this stuff move, or a dog, we don't have to go to aliens, we can go to dogs. A dog watching all of this stuff move, or a cat, just completely blind to it.
Feels weakening like, or something,
Kind of so, feels like that.
Mm-hmm. If you're well, it's doing part something. Of you that's dying. Yeah. Or weakening, right? Like it, so it has to give up, and it's painful, right?
Yeah.
And that's why a radical personality transformation, you know, if you fail dreadfully, so imagine you fail in a marriage, let's say, because it's betrayed.
In one of the previous videos, I talked about the reasons people come to church. People come to church because of failure. And people have conversion experiences after, often after, a radical failure. And they're broken, they're dead, and they're looking for, and they're sort of broken apart, and something new can come in.
What you failed at is a pattern that's co-activated with almost everything you do, right? Because if you're married to someone, the fact that you're married is a predicate of everything that you're involved in, the way you look at the world, the way you think about yourself, the way you conduct yourself. And then when that collapses, all of that is punished, all of it. And so, well, that's enough of a death. You know, if you're like 75 years old, your wife dies, there's a real high probability you'll die in the next year.
And this not only sort of an illustration about the extent that marriage sort of maps, you know, gets into your map, but also grief. One of the things, again, as a pastor you deal with often is grief. People die, and then people have to deal with the grief. And again, from sort of a physicalist perspective, you could look around and say, well, people are always coming and going out of each other's lives. What difference does that death make? Oh, it makes an enormous difference in a relational world.
It just takes you out. You know, and even if it doesn't, if you're younger, a big party is going to die. And that's very, very painful. That grief and that reconstitution, that's all a partial death. And it can kill you, right? It can be so stressful that you just...
For example, if you're young and you lose a parent, a future dies. In other words, it's not just... It's all this potentiality. And when you listen to people who are grieving, you know, they will never come to my wedding. They will never see my children. They will never. In other words, we live in the midst of this enormous map of which we're only conscious of a tiny little portion of it. And then when you have a big loss like that, suddenly when you're going through your life and going through your map, all of these tells are triggered. Dad will never see this. Dad will never hear this. Dad will never know him. Dad will never know her. Just cascades all the way on through the person.
Die. But if you don't, a lot of you has to die. And then hypothetically, you know, reemerge. It takes a long time for the death, like a year, and a long time for the reemergence. Sometimes you don't reemerge either. You just end up, you know, three quarters dead.
And that's what happens with ideological beliefs too, right? Why people get stuck in it. And the thought of peace if you has to die.
And I hit the stop button, I'll go back. But very, very cogent application by Michaela connecting that to ideological beliefs.
Yeah. You know, three quarters dead.
And that's what happens with ideological beliefs too, right? Why people get stuck in it. Because in order to change your frame of thought, a piece of you has to die.
Yeah,
well you have so, I see this with respect to all sorts of things. You have so much sunk cost into a mapping of the world. And this is why, let's say, deconstructions out of the church, they're sort of celebrated, and a lot of people around you might cheer because, I don't know why they cheer, because, well, your Sunday mornings are now free. But in our culture, people sort of celebrate it. But it's when you listen to people who deconstruct, it's a grief. It's a death. Something that has been mapped pervasively on them is now changed. And so ideologically, religiously, these are why these patterns are very durable, because they're very pervasive.
Well, not, it's worse than that. A piece of you has to die, and it might be a lot of you, but also when that piece dies, it's not like it's replaced immediately by a new functional piece. You lose the...
Just chaos. That's
right. That's the desert. We just released this Exodus seminar.
Okay, before we get to Exodus, but that's what I watch with people who leave the faith, is they something happens, or something has built up in them that they no longer, that there are certain costs to holding this belief system, and so they no longer think it's in their best interest to hold on to it, so it goes away. And at first there's something of a euphoria, but often it's a very hard thing because, well, maybe all their family still goes to church. Maybe all of their friends still listen to Christian music. Maybe they're still well ensconced. That's part of the reason why a lot of people sort of deconstruct and they sort of do it secretly. And you'll find people, and, you know, again, people tell pastors their secrets sometimes, and, you know, they'll basically tell you that, well, they haven't believed for years. Sometimes it's pastors.
Right, and one of the things that happens to the Israelites, once they leave the tyranny of Egypt, they end up lost in the desert. Of course, that's part of the mystery of the story. It's like,
now, one of the things that you'll notice is that Peterson goes to the Bible more and more and more. Well, why? Well, this is, again, one of the subtle, if you start going to church, you have that pattern of every week, you're at least having someone else pay a little bit of attention to you, you know, throw some Bible into your attention screen. If you're doing daily devotions or if you're doing daily prayer, a little bit more attention. And so what the sort of the drip, drip, drip does of religion is begin to, again, remake that map pervasively. Now, it isn't necessarily all going to be exactly like, let's say, the pastor wants it to be or something like that. But Peterson, in writing this book, Peterson in doing the Exodus seminar, Peterson in taking on this big challenge of wanting to go through the whole Bible, because again, that's his goal. This is, in a sense, what he's doing for himself. He is sort of remapping his insides via the Bible, his map via the Bible, and you're going to hear more and more Bible come out of his mouth. And again, the impact that this is going to have socially is he's going to be continue to be affirmed, but there'll also be critique from Christians because, well, you're not doing it right. But there'll also be openness to people who before didn't have any Bible in their life, and now suddenly, because they like Peterson, he has credibility. We're going to talk a little bit about the way that he does it. And, you know, Mark LaFaber talks about this. Adam Friend had talked to me about that a while ago, how he sort of stays on a line and how he does his concordism. It's part of the reason he's having an effect on people who don't necessarily go to church or consider themselves to be religious.
It's not a very big desert where they're lost. It wouldn't take 40 years to walk across it.
Well, the truth is, and it's helpful to remember, that actually they cross it in 2 years and they get to the border of the Promised Land and they send in the spies and then they have a faith crisis and they go back into the desert. And the reason they go into the desert to camp in the desert is that so an entire generation will die. That's what the book of Numbers is about. The book of Numbers is, and that's how the numbers serve in the book, is that an entire generation dies in the desert. So a new generation that are not of Egypt. I mean, basically the way, this is a sobering idea. The way, it's always say, it's easier to get people out of Egypt than Egypt out of people. The way they get Egypt out of Israel is basically kill off almost all of the Israelites that lived in Egypt. That way, the younger generation grows up in the desert. They have desert, God dependence desert on them. They're the ones that are going to inherit the land.
It's three generations. But what happens is that in the aftermath of the collapse of a tyrannical belief system, well, the tyranny disappears, but then you're lost. And it's not obvious at all that being lost is preferable to being in the tyranny. And that's why people will develop nostalgia for the tyranny. It's also why people won't let go of their beliefs. It's like, imagine you stubbornly stick to a counterproductive pattern of behavior, and you even know it's counterproductive, but you won't let it go. Think, well, why would you be so damn daft not to let go of something that you know is hurting you? And the answer is, well, better the devil you know than the desert you don't.
I've got my map. It might not be a good map, but it's mine. And, I mean, he's exactly right.
Right. It's a really big problem. And in the Exodus story, there's an emphasis. It's like, the desert period, it might extend past your lifetime.
Ugh.
Right. Well, you know, if a whole...
And this is a huge point. The basic religion of secular America is sort of a hedonism. Have your best life now from 0 to 80. Even most of the world never lived like this, because the reality he just pointed to, everybody understood. By virtue of our affluence, by virtue of our security, we actually hope to have your best life between 0 and 80. And the reality is that many people won't. Many people are going to be alcoholics. They're going to suffer abuse. They're going to have disorders. They're going to have disabilities. Many people around the world, they're just hoping maybe the next generation, the sacrifices that they invest will help the next generation. But it's amazing, you know, Michaela's response to this sort of really, I think it's very typical of people, because via the screens in our world, we are fed a message that you can have it all. You can have your best life now. And we're always comparing ourselves to people on the screens. And you know, these two people are very successful. You know, Michaela, I would assume Michaela's done very well business-wise. She's really developed that. She's got a sizable YouTube following. Now, you might knock her and say, well, that's because her daddy. Yeah, but, you know, if you listen to the rest of this video, not the video I'm making, but the video that they're making, you'll realize that in many ways, it was also the opportunity to, and the necessity to help manage her father's stuff, and the mentoring by her father that helped her become, and also the griefs and hardships she suffered, that helped her become the kind of negotiator that she is. And again, if you look at, you know, the Daily Wire thing, I mean, basically it sounds like they got everything they wanted to, and it was Michaela that drove the hard bargain. And I think part of that is because, and she touches on it a little bit later in the video, is because she got to a point in her life when she realized, what do I have to lose? Because if I keep being normal, I am going to die young. So why not stop eating everything but meat? And why not start talking about this? And why not? And why not? And why not? And actually, for some, that's a recipe for success. Other people say, why not? And then it winds up being the last thing. Why not invent bungee jumping with thinner and thinner bungees? Might not end well. But, you know, but what Peterson lays down here is so important, and our culture just doesn't grasp it.
Culture has an emphasis. It's like, it might, the desert period, it might extend past your lifetime.
Ugh.
Right. Well, you know, if a whole tyrannical
society. And again, the Book of Numbers, the desert period is designed to kill off the generation that saw the plagues in Egypt. They die off because they get to the end of the promised land, and instead of going in, they say, our children are going to die at the hands of these giants. And the Lord sort of turns the tables on them and says, no, actually, you're going to die in the desert, and your children are going to beat the giants. There's a lesson in that too.
Society collapses.
Yeah.
There's no reason to assume that the society is going to regenerate within the span of your life. You know, you might just be the cohort that's cast into the desert. That happened in Russia, in the Soviet Union after it collapsed.
And if you're in that boat, and you're a hedonist, secular, atheist American, what do you have left? And then the answer is, well, you can always kill yourself. Oh, well, that's blessing the world. No. This is a huge issue, and it's a huge point. And I think it's people again, for 100 years, well, religion's going to disappear. Well, you know what? When things collapse, and they regularly do, you know who goes away? Atheists die off faster. And religious people continue to go and hang in there because they actually have a motivation that transcends the collapse of their world. And actually, he's going to talk about this a little bit later. He says something which I think is super key.
So if you were like 45 or older in 1989, or 50, let's say, you're just screwed, right? Because everything that you knew collapsed, and you're 50. You know, you're near retirement. You're going to start again?
And these collapses happen to individual people. There's a divorce, there's cancer, there's a bankruptcy, there's a big theft, there's a betrayal, there's an embezzlement, and they never catch up. I remember talking to a friend of mine who was in his second marriage, and he was happily in his second marriage, but he said to me, he said, "I never recovered from my divorce." What do you mean? Financially. Never recovered from my divorce. If I hadn't divorced my wife financially, I would be much further ahead than I am now. And, you know, he wasn't living in poverty, but, you know, just struggling to make ends meet when he was 65 years old and didn't have a lot to live on in retirement. And there's a lot of people like that.
Well, you're three-fifths done or four-fifths done. There's no... Lots of people can't start again or won't, even if they're 30.
Hey, guys, did you know that Dad did it all my right list? You know, I'm just used to having this money when the moving's over at all and came off this because of what happened to the belief system that fell was like full-blown trust in the medical system because of what happened to me. And when that fell, I've talked about this a bit, it impacted almost every part of my life where I was like, I believed that, you know, I believed that that was how I was going to get better. It didn't make me better. Something else outside of that got me better, which is the diet that we're on, which was ridiculous.
Yeah, or your own exploratory capacity.
Yes, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that was...
And in some ways, she had the kind of father who would go to the short order cook and say, you know, you're messing this breakfast thing up. Let me, you don't have to. Let me show you. I like coming to eat here. I like coming to eat here with my friends. I don't want to look for a new restaurant. I'd rather fix you. That was a part of it. I mean, she's a child is a child of both parents. And, you know, the parents are always looking at the mix, but they're always a child of both parents.
The first belief system that fell, and then I lost trust in everything.
Yeah,
like,
okay,
if that was wrong... Is the government wrong?
Well,
what else is wrong?
This is something that Nietzsche pointed out with regards to the psychological consequences of European colonialism on Europe. So he said, okay, imagine Europe is Christendom, all things considered, when the European expansion started. Okay, now the Europeans go out into the world, and there's some arguments within Christendom about which branch of Christianity should rule, you know, and there's doubters.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
But basically, as far as the Europeans were concerned, the cosmos was structured according to Judeo-Christian precepts. It was just the assumption network. Okay, so now the Europeans go out in the world, and they find out that there's a lot of different belief systems, equally well-developed, or arguably equally well-developed, apparently predicated on different axiomatic systems. Okay, so now that brings
that's
up
weird.
Down.
Pluralism. And you'll hear me talking about this regularly. Pluralism. And Nietzsche is right. If this is the kind of stuff he talks about in his Nietzsche class in Peterson Academy, I might have to find a way to listen to it.
Yeah.
So the doubt is, well, you know, the Japanese, Chinese, they seem to be doing pretty well. And they're not, or better even in some regards... I think you could.
And at the beginning of the colonial period, the Chinese were doing better.
I could argue that when the Europeans hit Japan, that the Japanese had attained a higher level of sophisticated civilization in many ways. They were certainly well advanced in the hygienic front, for example.
Yeah.
And so that's the first doubt. The first doubt is, there's a bunch of belief systems. But then Nietzsche pointed out, but then there's a secondary doubt, which is once you realize that a belief system per se, especially a relatively core one, can collapse, that raises not only the specter of which belief system is correct, but another specter, which is, well, what makes you think any belief system is justifiable?
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And that's the nihilist trap. It's like, everything is meaningless. Right? And, you know, and that's a hard trap to get out of. And we're certainly still, Nietzsche knew that after the death of God, which was something he regarded as really the ultimate catastrophe, the ultimate murder, that two things were most likely to happen. One would...
What do you mean by the death of God? And this is where this whole conversation, is there a God, is so poorly formed. I think it all has to do with, can I have a productive relationship with God? God, whatever you know, what do you mean by God? And you know, AA sort of builds on that. You don't have to, they intentionally avoid defining God, but sort of use it as a placeholder, a higher power, and say, you need to approach that higher power relationally for actually for it to work. And again, if the nihilists were right, I would think all religions would have collapsed. But if the nihilists were right, I don't think any religions ever would have gotten traction. And religions as a category that we talk about, and we're going to have to talk about that a lot more, not in this video because I have limited time, but they never would have dominated the world and are going to continue to dominate the world for exactly the reason that I just spoke about a couple minutes ago, and that we'll revisit very quickly when he gets to the point here.
Would be a descent into a kind of counterproductive nihilism, the loss of all values, that's how he construed it, and all the psychological disorientation that goes along with that. And the other would be a radical turn towards a replacement totalitarian certainty, which he believed and said would likely come from the radical left in the form of something approximating communism.
And the truth is, of course, if you listen to the rest of history, long time ago they did an episode on communism. And in many ways, communism is sort of an attempt to secularize and have a, you know, within the iron box of secularism to, we're going to kind of have a Christian relational utopia here. Now, of course, they cut out Augustinian assumptions about human depravity, and they just imagine that, well, people are going to do the right thing out of the goodness of their heart, and, well, apparently the goodness of our hearts as a global system isn't quite sufficient to hold up communism, and it all collapses. But it's helpful to know that in some ways communism on the left is sort of the Christian alternative, and the fascism on the right is sort of, you know, Augustine on steroids in terms of imagine. It's probably not. I'll take that back. But it's a radically secular environmental religion that sort of makes a fetish out of natural selection, let's say.
Nailed that like 1850. Stunning. And Dostoevsky knew exactly the same thing. They both got it exactly right. And that is exactly what happened. And then there's another way of thinking about it too, is that you look at the world through a hierarchy of presuppositions, of axioms.
Yeah.
So like if you're married, one of the axioms...
And these axioms, these presuppositions are inherited from your parents and your culture and your world. I mean, they're not sifted through with science and reason and evidence. They're simply mapped on. You don't have time in your life to go into the world without a map.
And this would be the definition of marriage. One of the axioms of marriage is likely trust on the interpersonal communication front. Like you have to assume that your partner is revealing to you what they are. And then sexual fidelity would be the other, and those are obviously integrally associated. But those are the two, you could argue, those are the two fundamental pillars. Okay, so everything else in the marriage, and that would be your self-conception, your conception of your future, the past, your partner, other people, all of them depend on the integrity of those axioms. And so if either of those axioms are challenged, so your partner lies to you in some fundamental way or betrays you on the sexual front, the whole edifice tumbles down.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, the interesting thing about infidelity, sexual infidelity, is on one hand, you've got sort of the polyamorous people running around out there saying, no, non-attachment in terms of sexuality, blah, 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 blah. Well, why is that such a key thing? And again, I think it's all about attention. Because what happens if, let's say, you're having an affair is that your attention will be drawn away from your spouse, drawn away from your family, drawn away from that whole map, and you start to develop an alternative map. Now, that's people who, let's say, aren't sex addicts like Russell Brand was, apparently, and, you know, you're just having sex with all sorts of people. That's a whole separate addiction. This is someone who, for one reason or another, you know, sees something that they sort of might think they want to prefer and test out, and so suddenly the way attention figures into this matrix is disturbed. And that will, again, that will kill the future.
And that, yeah. And okay, and so what happens technically there is that edifice gives you security because things are defined, and so they're not all the, look, if you can't trust someone, you don't know who the hell they are, mm-hmm. right? And when you're facing someone and you don't know who they are, they could be anyone.
Yeah. Like and by who they are, he means how they're going to behave in the future. Can you rely on them to not blow all of your money in the casino, to not abuse your children when you're not around, to not steal your parents' money?
They could be
anybody.
Mother Teresa or yeah. Ted Bundy. Right, that's a big range, okay? So someone you can't trust.
And most people fall somewhere in the middle.
It's a nightmare of entropy. And the reason they're a nightmare of entropy is because you don't know which direction to take. Like there are a multitude of there are an infinite multitude of potential directions. Okay, the systems within you that signal anxiety signal the emergence of that multitude of pathways. It's like, you know, I've seen this in interviews I've had. It's like, you know, I thought they were good faith interviews, and then I discovered that I was talking
Never
to
assume
a snake.
That.
Yeah,
yeah,
no kidding. It's like, oh, I see. You're not who you claim to be, and whatever's happening here isn't what I thought.
Yeah.
And a lot of that has to do with the therapeutic mask. Experimental theology. I can't. I was going to say Glenn Beck. No, I had him on the channel. I can't remember his first name. He's doing a great series on the defense of the therapeutic, and the fact that he has to sort of defend the therapeutic is telling, because the therapeutic has now sort of become the lying mask to cow and to domesticate and to pacify the masses.
What's going on? And the answer is God only knows, right? So anxiety signals that. Anxiety comes up and says, you thought you were here in the walled garden, but it turns out that you're in chaos. And then because you don't know how difficult it will be to get out of the chaos and reestablish order, your brain says, warning, multiple pathways ahead, multiple indeterminate pathways ahead. That equates to incalculable expense of energy and time probable, right? And so you get anxious. That's what freezes you.
Now, this is where religion comes in, because you want to dismiss him as the sky daddy? Well, this is where belief in a higher power, belief in God, belief in that being is good. I mean, and again, the more you've sort of built into this, the more you've made this a part of your life, it doesn't mean that bad things won't happen. What it means is when this stuff sort of breaks up in your life, you've still got a map to hold you together to get you through the world. That's what religion does. It gives you a map that is durable enough. Viktor Frankl saw it. I've used this illustration many times. Viktor Frankl and his father noted that those in the Nazi camp needed something outside that destructive zone in order to maintain themselves within this destructive zone. Again, I've told the story before. They're in the line, and one of the people is saying, because the women's camp is right over there, have you seen my wife? Have you seen my wife? And Viktor Frankl's father said, yes, I just saw her. She looked well. She's doing well. And I saw your daughter, and she's doing well too. Okay. And then he would live. And Viktor Frankl stops his father and says, why did you tell him that? That's a lie. It's because the minute he thinks his wife is dead, he's dead. So what religion does, a good religion, is that it actually buoys you in there, that I can point to you to Christian songs, tough parts of my life where, you know, things were really difficult. That's when you sort of, you begin to lean into your faith and you realize that God is enough. Well, what do you mean by that language? You mean, yep, you look at the story of Job, you look at all sorts of other stories and you say, where they get a little bit later here, because they're going to have this really interesting segment of faith a little bit. Boy, I got to keep going in this because I got a Bible study at 7.
You don't know which direction to go. You turn to stone. So when the mythological hero faces the terrible, chaotic feminine, let's say, with a head of snakes, it's a predator, he freezes. And the reason for that is, well, if you don't know what direction to go, how about you don't move? Right, that's anxiety. It's a signal of emergent entropy. And entropy can tear you apart, right? It's complete disorder.
So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I have like 4 or 5 questions from that whole thing that just happened. But I think the first one, what do people do if something they fundamentally believed changes and they're left in this state of what's even stable in my life? Like, where do you start when you're frozen?
Okay, so back to the book of Exodus. This is so cool. Jonathan Pazur.
So I always put Peugeot, the accent after the G, he always says Peugeot. I don't know why.
Joe explained this to all of us. And like, I don't think any of us ever recovered after he explained it because it's so bloody brilliant. So the Israelites are out in the desert, right? They're lost and they have the habits of slaves, so they don't know what they're doing. And they're all bitchy and they're whining about having the tyranny back and they're bitching about Moses and they're worshiping like golden calves and they're fighting with each other. Yeah. It's just like chaos. So they don't know where to go. And so God appears to them. And God appears as a pillar of light at night, so it's a fire, and a pillar of darkness during the day. And so Peugeot said, that's the same thing as the Taoist yin and yang. It's the same idea. So what does it mean? Well, in the Taoist worldview, reality itself, so that's experiential reality, is made out of the balance between chaos and order, okay? Now, order is where you are when things are going the way you want them to go. That's order. And chaos is where you don't know what the hell's going on. So chaos is also possibility, right? And the future is chaos, and novelty is chaos. Now, in the Taoist worldview, the little serpent, because it's a serpent, that's the white serpent, their head-to-head, has a black dot in it. It's because order can turn into chaos at the drop of a hat.
Yeah.
And the black serpent has a white dot in it because chaos can reveal a new order. And that's the interplay of reality, the interplay between the unknown and the known. Now, when you're guided by that which grips your interest optimally, right? So you're attentive because you're interested in something, you're focused on it. What it means is that chaos and order are balanced for you in a way that doesn't flood you too much, so you're not too terrified. But that isn't so predictable that no transformation is taking place in front of. Now, you might think, well, what I want to be is stable. And the answer, that's wrong. You don't want to be stable. You want to be stable and improving, right? Okay, so something will beckon to you as compelling and interesting if it's exactly on the frontier between chaos and order that will move your development forward, right? And when that happens, you're engaged. That's the instinct of meaning. That's how God manifests himself to the Israelites in the desert. It's that the thing that grips your attention, it's like the snitch that Harry Potter chases and wins the game.
Yeah.
You know, that's...
Well, it's not only that, but the pillar of fire at night and the pillar of cloud by day also orients the camp. So if you look at the layout of the camp, you've got the tabernacle, and the pillar is on is over the tabernacle, because the tabernacle is this sort of divine containment unit or this divine shield so that people don't get too close, because that will destroy them. And, you know, they can look away, but it always orients them. You always know where you are. Carl, remember Carl, who, you know, was big fan of the channel for a while until he wasn't? He talked about when he was growing up in France, there was this one cathedral, very famous cathedral, I've never been to France, I don't know which one, off in the distance. And he said, you could see that cathedral wherever you were, and that oriented you. So you always knew who you were and where you were because the cathedral was that orientation, sort of how the pillar of fire and the pillar of cloud. And now, again, it's interesting because it's darkness in daytime and it's light at night. And in a lot of ways, that's how God is. If it's light out and you think everything's going great, I can see everything, everything's fine, God is in some ways that troubling voice, maybe of conscience, maybe that's calling you again to, because he said, you know, he's right. You don't want to be just stable. You want to be stable and improving. And so when it's light out, the pillar of darkness calls you to look where you don't want to look and to address what you need to address. Now, when it's dark out, the pillar of fire, now that's a beacon. And so you're oriented during the light times and during the dark times.
That's the thing that dances and grabs your attention. And so you could think of God in the story of Exodus as that which calls to you. And you see a precursor of that in Exodus, because Moses leaves Egypt at one point. He kills an Egyptian who has beaten up an Israelite. And he kills him. And then the word gets around and he's afraid the Pharaoh's going to kill him. So he leaves and he goes to this land, Midia. I think it's Midia. His father-in-law is a Midianite priest. So I think it's Midia, but the people who live there are Midianites anyways. He marries one of the priest's daughters and he settles into their household. And like, he's very valued there because he rescued the girls.
For 40 years.
When he married from these like thugs at a well, and they're pretty happy with Moses. Yeah. And now he's a shepherd, and he's a shepherd is a guide and a leader, right? That's what a shepherd does. And a shepherd protects the weak, because that's also what a shepherd does. And remember, in the Middle East at this time, there's lions and wolves. And like, you're not some trivial dude if you're a...
Remember, Michaela, I don't know if you have to remember that if you ever knew it before, but now you know it. He's right.
Shepherd, because you're out there alone and then where there's predators, and you're, you know, taking care of the vulnerable.
So that's
the leader.
Food.
Yeah. That's the leader, right? That's why the shepherd is a leader figure in the Old Testament. You have a rod that you move the sheep with and fight off the predators, and that's Moses. And he's having a perfectly fine time. He doesn't even want to go back to Egypt. And he goes, it actually happens near Mount Sinai. He encounters a burning bush. And so Moses is going about his business, and all of a sudden something attracts his attention. And he decides to go off his path, right? So the path of normality, to attend to this thing that captures his interest. And it's not like a burning forest. It's just something that glitters, right? It's a call. And so Moses goes to investigate. And as he...
I really like that. It's not like a burning forest. That's really good.
He approaches it. He realizes that it's a burning bush. And so what does that mean? Well, a tree is a symbol of life. Like the tree of life, right? The tree is a symbol of life because, well, trees are alive, obviously, but that branching complexity is sort of emblematic of life.
And they connect heaven and earth.
And a burning tree is being and becoming at the same time, because fire is transformation. And so the burning bush is a symbol of being and becoming simultaneously, right? And so Moses investigates this. And as he investigates it more deeply, he hears a voice, and the voice says, you're starting to trail.
Wow, you know, being and becoming, that really maps on then into the Tetragrammaton, the name of the Lord. I am who I am, I will be who I will be.
And on sacred ground. And so he takes off his shoes and continues to investigate. And that's when God himself reveals himself to Moses and then really transforms him into a...
And it's very interesting, because in that text, I was reading that text with my Wednesday night Bible study, which I have to go to at 7 o'clock, so I got to keep moving on this. But you'll notice in the text where the Lord says to Moses, I didn't give this name to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph. I'm giving this name to you now. I was Lord Almighty to them. I was God Almighty to them. But I'm giving you this name now. It's really interesting where, of course, throughout Genesis, the name is used. But he says to Moses, I'm giving you this name now. It's a disclosing and unfolding revelation that's progressive.
Revelatory leader. And the idea there is, it's such an amazing idea, and I think it's absolutely right, is that, you know, you're going to be walking down your pathway in life, and maybe you're perfectly content. And something is going to glitter.
Okay, watch the move he just made right there. There's the homiletical move. And again, his homiletical move goes through psychology.
And gleam in the periphery, capture your interest, right? And it's partly you, because it's you that's interested, but it's partly the world calling to you, because you don't get to say what makes you interested, right? It sort of happens to you.
Yeah.
It's a synchronicity. Like, it's a place where the narrative and the objective touch. And so if you decide to go off your pathway and invest...
Remember what he asked Peugeot in his first interview with Peugeot, or Peugeot for him, when, you know, can the narrative and the physical, basically he didn't frame it that way, can the narrative and the physical touch, can they embrace? And of course, John 1, Logos, the word becomes flesh and tabernacled among us.
Investigate what interests you. And you investigate it enough, you go deeper and deeper and deeper. And if you go deep enough, you get on sacred ground. And that's where you're getting so deep that you're starting to study that which everything depends on. And then if you continue to study, you'll get right to the bottom of things itself. That's Moses' encounter with the divine.
Well, the sacred is another heightening of the attention. It's then a special category. It's that which is on top of the attention hierarchy. That's the sacred.
You do that, you will be a leader, right? And so you say, well, what guides you when you're lost? Well, the manifestation of intrinsic meaning guides you when you're lost. You can hear that in music, like music.
There's Peterson's gospel right there, the manifestation of intrinsic meaning. If you go back to my old videos, you know, for Peterson, meaning is a gyroscope, the experience of meaning. Do you feel something to be meaningful? Follow it. Now, you got to be really careful with that because, of course, a bunch of the people that he's sort of battling on the culture war front, what's guiding them is their experience of meaning. They now are going to save the world by participating in this activism and being out there to protest and to pour cans of soup on artwork, and that gives them meaning. So again, this is where I critique them, because that gyroscope of the experience of meaning isn't enough. It isn't enough, because basically it has to be oriented and connected all the way up. And that's what revelation does.
Plays out the balance between chaos and order properly.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It sort of tells you what is intrinsically meaningful and necessary and beautiful and true, all of that. And it's so cool because it works out neurologically, really. Like, it is the case that you advance.
And this, again, what he did right now, you're talking about the Bible, and he connects it to psychology, and then he says it works out neurologically. Now he's pointing to the physical, and so basically what he's doing is he's connecting heaven and earth with this. He's connecting the upper and lower registers. He's pulling it all together, and this gives his messaging plausibility, because, again, people have this multi-generational formation of trusting in science. And he's using all these scientific words, and so suddenly the universe sort of comes back together again.
Developmentally on the edge of chaos, right? Because you have to push yourself to advance.
Yeah.
That's what you do when you play. Like, if you're playing one-on-one basketball with someone, you don't want to be 6'4" and play with your, like, 4'2" nephew and just stomp him to death. And you think, well, why not? Because you could beat the little bastard nonstop. It's like, I'm the victor. You don't want that, right? You want to find someone who can push you. Maybe you want to play with someone who's slightly better than you. Now, why? Because it's harder to win. And the answer is, well, the win means that you're developing. That's the meta win. And you obtain the meta win on the border of chaos. And that's all the place where the hero operates. And that's where you find the dragon and all of that. It's exactly the same thing. And meaning, the instinct of meaning signifies that developmental edge. And the
instinct, but again, for him, where it connects up with the person is the meaning as gyroscope. And so, again, this is classic Peterson. This is the same thing that he's been saying since Maps of Meaning.
Constant mythological insistence is that God is to be found at the core of what makes itself manifest as meaning. And that's a definition, you know, and say, well, people think, well, you know, I don't believe in God. It's like, the belief in God is not adherence to a set of semantic propositions. That's just not how it works. It's not like reading a set of descriptors and saying, I concur. It's not that at all. It's being guided by, the spirit of truth. That's one way of thinking about it. Guided by the spirit of adventure. That's another way of thinking about it. And it's faith in meaning. It's faith in truth. Those aren't propositional ideas. And they fit the neurology perfectly, because the instinct of meaning manifests itself on the edge of development. That's how your brain's set up.
So if you're floating around in chaos because one of your belief systems failed, whether that's your job or your belief in the medical system or your relationship or something like that, your suggestion is wait for something meaningful to appear, because it'll appear and then pursue it.
Or watch. Like, one of the things you do with people who are depressed, if you're a behavioral therapist, is you say, okay, let's have you track your mood for the next 2 weeks. Yeah. Like, you're going to think, because you're depressed, it's like, how do you feel? 2 out of 10. Win. Always. It's like, no, not always. If you track your mood, you'll find that even if you're severely depressed, you'll vary, say, between 0 and 4 out of 10.
And again, Peter's sort of, he's got the credibility. Now he's going to give something super practical.
Okay, so now it might be that you find, this is very common, you find that even though you don't want to see your friends, if you're with them, you're at 4. Okay. And then maybe there'll be some other things. If I listen to music, if I'm painting, if I'm working out, if I'm building a shelf or whatever, there'll be different things that people find compelling. My mood lifts. And here's some other things I'm doing where I'm at 0.
Yeah.
Okay, let's start doing fewer of the 0 things and more of the 4 things and see how far we can go. And then maybe you practice that for a month and now you're doing some 6 out of 10 things. Like, there'll be domains of your life that make themselves manifest as more able to chase away the darkness. And you need to discover what those are. And you have to be humble, which is, you don't know, because what do you know about yourself? The things that you find meaningful, that make themselves manifest as meaningful, you might not want to even admit. Like, maybe you have a woman who's hell-bent on her career for ideological reasons, but if you get her to track her mood, she's far happier when she's with her kids. Or the reverse, right? You might have a woman who would like to believe that having her children is enough, but if you track her mood, you find that if she isn't out pursuing her career 30% of the time, she's devastated. And it's an empirical, you call this in behavioral therapy, you call this collaborative empiricism. And so the idea is, well, I don't know who the hell you are, and neither do you. So how about we watch, and that's humility. It's right, like, I don't know. And you have to be brought to your knees to watch that seriously. Well, and so then you can find, and then, you know, there's a reliable pattern to the things that make your life meaningful. So, and this is one of the things I've talked to my audiences a lot about, is that so you might say, well, I want to be happy. And people say that all the time, and they don't even know what the hell they mean when they say that. What they actually mean is that they don't want to suffer too much.
Yeah.
But they don't say, I don't want to be unhappy. They say, I want to be happy. But happiness is incentive reward, and it only occurs sporadically when you're pursuing a goal. And happiness has its dangers too, because it makes you impulsive. And when people say they want to be happy, they actually don't know what they mean. And what they really mean is something like, I want to have a meaning that will sustain me even through catastrophe.
Right there. he's just put his finger on it right there.
And that's not happiness, because what do you mean? And what they really mean is something like, I want to have a meaning that will sustain me even through catastrophe.
And that's what a relationship with God will give you. And again, now it's going to depend on the aspects of God, the attributes of God, what kind of a God it is. I've been reading, what's the name of that book? Larry Hurtado's Destroyer of the Gods. Great book. Really enjoying it. It's my latest, you know, thing I grab in puppy prison on my Kindle Scribe. And he goes into this question, uses a lot of Rodney Stark, and, you know, why did Christianity grow? What religion? What about it made it work? And I think what Peterson just said here was just so absolutely foundational.
They actually don't know what they mean. And what they really mean is something like, I want to have a meaning that will sustain me even through catastrophe.
I want to have a meaning that will sustain me even through catastrophe. And what religion does, the practice of religion, going to church, doing devotions, all of that is to draft this deeply onto your map and get it in there deeply. And so you're taking all of these hits and still going forward, and not going forward with bitterness, not going forward with anger, not going forward with envy and jealousy and all of these negative motivators, but going forward with joy and generosity and goodness. That's what it's for. And again, in Christianity, we follow a man who, when he is hanging from the cross, says, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do."
And that's not happiness, because when you're in a catastrophe, which you will be, or maybe always are, yeah, you're not going to be happy. Okay, so where do people find meaning? And my conclusion, fundamentally, it's not mine, this is this fundamental axiom of Western civilization, is you find true meaning in voluntary self-sacrifice.
Wonder where we got that idea from. I don't know, maybe a guy hanging naked on the cross when his disciples ran away. Voluntary self-sacrifice. There's the cross. There's more to this. There's a lot more to this, but I am out of time. I have a Bible study to do. Anyway, I will probably finish listening to this video tonight or tomorrow. I usually get a little bit of chance early in the morning or what have you. Tomorrow's Thursday, sermon day. I got to get my PowerPoint draft done. So Friday I can do my vocal draft and so on and so forth. But this was a great video. This was really good. The Peterson Academy stuff is super interesting. The ARC stuff is interesting. There's a lot of interesting stuff right now. So very cool. So leave a comment. Let me know what you think.